This is Radio Times in Review. I'm Marty Moscoen. Thanks for joining us. Albert Einstein's name is synonymous with genius. A pioneer in the field of theoretical physics, many of his ideas and theories remain just that, theoretical. But just last week, one of his theories was actually proven about gravitational waves. And it said that the implications of this discovery could have the potential to make time travel a reality. Now, it's hard to wrap our brains around that idea. But we got a description when we were joined by Brian Green, theoretical physicist and author of the recently reprinted book, Fabric of the Cosmos. We talked all about Einstein, string theory, and time travel when he joined us in the studio in 2004. Let's take a listen. You ask and explain in a chapter, what is space? And the answer, you say, actually comes from a 300-year-old debate about a bucket of water.
Yes, yes.
Perhaps we could do that on the radio.
Well, strangely enough, a bucket of water, one that was introduced into the scientific context by Isaac Newton, does give us some insight into whether space is a real entity or just a useful idea for organizing where things are in our mind as opposed to something that's truly out there. The experiment's a little tricky to describe just in words, so I'll just say it quickly, and if we need to follow it up, maybe we can try to do so. If you have a bucket of water, according to Newton, and you wind it up on a rope, so it's hanging by a rope, it's now night and tightly taut, you let it go, the bucket starts to spin. At first, the water doesn't spin at all. It just stays nice and flat. But then the water begins to spin with the bucket. Friction makes the water start to spin too. And its surface, this is the key thing, its surface now takes on a curved shape. The question is, why does the water's surface take on a curved shape? The basic answer is, well, it's spinning. And so it kind of pushes outwards, and we all know that effect.
Centrifugal force
That's
or something
right.
like that.
But then Newton says, what if I do this experiment in empty space where there's nothing around? Well, we all know that motion is always a relative idea. Something's moving with respect to something else. That's what motion really means. If there's nothing else around and the water still takes on a concave shape, what is it spinning with respect to in empty space? The answer, according to Newton, space itself. Space is an entity, according to Newton and this little experiment. It is not just an idea. It's something that's real. Now, that's weird, right? Because you can't clutch space, you can't touch it, you can't smell it, you can't affect it. So how can you call it a real physical entity? Many people launched this criticism to Newton's bucket experiment. But the fact is, by having space as a real entity, Newton was able to write down equations that describe the motion of the moon or the motion of fruit falling from tree. And the equations worked. So this assumption that space is real, that he got to by this bucket experiment, seems to give answers that really work.
And do those answers work today with our understanding about, I mean, I'm thinking of Einstein and others who, of course, have weighed in on this as well.
Sure. Well, the key thing is, for 250 years, nobody really challenged Newton in any significant way because his equations did work.
Right.
But when Einstein came along, Einstein was the kind of person who was different. He put everything back on the table. There was no such thing as received wisdom for Albert Einstein. And when he rethought the true nature of space, he came to the conclusion that Newton was wrong. What he realized is that it's not space that's really out there as an entity on its own. It's space and time. When you put space and time together, you weave them into a unified whole, then that entity, according to Einstein's special theory of relativity is what it's called, that's a real entity. So what Newton did wrong was he kind of ripped space and time apart and declared each of them to exist. That pulling apart is not right. In their union, they exist as a real entity, according to Einstein's insights.
And so there's this notion then of space-time as
space-time,
one
that's
one
what
word.
We call it, exactly.
And I guess the only way, and you know, I'm showing my sheer ignorance here, but the only way that I feel that and understand that is when at night or anytime I look up and I realize that by looking up, I'm looking back in time.
I think that's a very good way to do it because it immediately shows you how intertwined space and time are. Because as you say, you look out into space, you see some distant star, you're seeing it as it was when it emitted the light that your eye is now receiving, and that could be 100, 1,000, 10,000, a million, a billion years ago if it's very far away. So you are looking out into space and also back into time. Einstein ran with that idea, however, and showed, rather shockingly, that the relationship between space and time is even deeper than that. He showed that if you and I are moving relative to one another, then what you would consider space, I would consider a mixture of space and time, and vice versa. And in practical terms, what that means is, well, sort of practical terms, if you're moving really quickly, say near the speed of light, then time for you will tick off at a very different rate than the rate at which it ticks off for me.
Well, we know that from astronauts, right? I mean, is that...
We don't really know from astronauts because the effects, even for astronauts, are incredibly tiny. So it is true that when astronauts go up and they go up in a very fast shuttle or something of that sort, when they come back, they may have aged, say, a billionth of a second less than us. It's not something that is obvious. Their hair isn't like nice and dark while ours is gray or something like that. So we can't actually see it from that, but we do see it, for instance, with little particles. We do have atom smashers, which can whirl particles around at very high speed. And there are species of particles that we know that when they're sitting still, they always fall apart in like a millionth of a second. They just disintegrate really quickly. But when you put them in one of these machines and they go really fast, time for them slows down. And they don't fall apart in a millionth of a second. They can live 2, 3, 5 seconds. So time for them has slowed down because of their motion. So this is experimentally proven.
Well, we've been talking about Newton. We've been talking about Einstein. I mean, how about today? And I know that you're a proponent of this string theory. Is that the sort of logical next step from Einstein?
It depends who you ask. I think it is the logical next step because it really is trying to achieve a dream that Einstein himself articulated, which is the dream of finding a unified theory. And what that means is a theory that perhaps from one equation or one idea might be able to describe everything in the universe, the big things, the small things, regardless of how fast they're moving, everything sort of in one package. And within string theory, and the pattern really is very clear, you know, Einstein came along with relativity, and that changed our understanding of space and time. String theory comes along with this unified theory, and it changes our understanding of space and time once again. Because this unified description, and we can get into this if you'd like, requires that the world have more than 3 spatial dimensions.
In fact, as many as, I mean, what, 9 or 10 dimensions?
9 or 10 spatial dimensions. And if you include time, that means 10 or 11 space-time dimensions. Now, that is so far from everyday experience that, again, it's a good example of how what we can see with ordinary perception deviates, assuming these ideas are correct, deviates substantially from how the world is really put together.
And
I should say, when I do my own research, I do not feel like I understand it if I'm just relying on the mathematics. So I constantly have mental imagery. The extra dimensions is perhaps the hardest one to have that mental image, that translation into a visual picture. But let me just say what it is, and then there are analogies that I think help. So in the world around us, we have left, right, we have back, forth, we have up, down. Those are the 3 familiar dimensions. Whenever we move, our motion is some combination of motion in those 3 independent directions. The theory claims that there are other directions in addition to left, right, back, forth, and up, down. Where are they and how do you picture them? It's kind of tricky. You know, you can think of lower dimensional versions. I mean, if you think of a little ant walking along a tiny, tiny thread, it may only think that there's one dimension there. But let's say you now turn the thread into a straw, so it has a circular dimension around it. If that circular dimension is very small, the ant won't know about it. But if the straw gets bigger and bigger, now the ant can easily walk not only back and forth along the length, but can also walk clockwise and counterclockwise, a new tiny direction that only becomes visible when you make the object a little bit bigger. So in our world, it could be that there are extra dimensions, like the circular part of the straw, but they're so tiny that we just can't see them.
I guess from your perspective, past, present, and future are an illusion.
Well, this is actually an idea that really does go back to Einstein. There's a famous quote where basically Einstein said that the notion of past, present, and future is only an illusion, however persistent. And it certainly is persistent because our minds seem to organize experience into the past, which is kind of gone, the present, which we view as real, and the future as yet to be. Now, in relativity, we learn that that division doesn't really make sense in the notion of it's not something that everybody would agree on. So again, if you and I are moving relative to each other, what you consider to be past, I might consider future. What you consider future, I might consider past. And in fact, things that you might consider future, I might consider present. And things that you consider past, I as well might consider present. So when we take your point of view and my point of view together, the notion that the past is gone doesn't make sense because it's real for you. Mm. The notion that the future is yet to be doesn't make sense because, again, it might be real for me or for you. So taking all the perspectives together, it really seems as though all of time is out there, just like all of space. We have no trouble with that. We imagine that being out there. We really need to think of all of space and time as being out there. So this notion of time sort of flowing from past to present to future doesn't really seem to stand up to relativistic scrutiny, no matter how intuitive it feels.
Which means that mathematically, you could have time travel. I mean, that it, as a mathematical idea.
Further than that. I'd say that Einstein taught us that time travel of a particular sort, time travel to the future, is not just mathematically possible, it's physically possible. Mm. This is, I believe, not controversial. And if any of my colleagues are listening and they disagree, I'd be interested to hear. Time travel to the future is part of the laws of physics as currently accepted. Einstein showed us, for instance, if you want to see what the Earth is like 10,000 years or a million years from now, he showed us how to do it. You build a spaceship, you travel out into space near the speed of light, you turn around and you come back. And depending upon your journey, how long you went and so forth, a year might have elapsed for you, while 10,000 or 100,000 or a million years will have elapsed on Earth. You will have traveled, you will have leapfrogged into Earth's future. This is relativity as we understand it. Building the ship and doing that journey, look, that's not something we can literally do, but we're talking about the laws of physics, not things that you can actually accomplish today. The tricky thing is time travel to the past, and that's the one which makes us all more queasy. And I think, and many people in the field agree, that one day we will rule out time travel to the past. But as an
impossibility?
As an impossibility, I think so. But it's very interesting, I think, just to note that we have not done that yet to anybody's satisfaction. And there's some real physicists, real bona fide physicists, who have even suggested how you might build a time machine to travel to the past. You know, when we study those proposals, we see that they kind of brush right up against the laws of physics, and we pretty much think that if we understood physics better, they'd cross over the edge and they would just be ruled out. But we haven't ruled them out yet.
That was my 2004 interview with theoretical physicist Brian Green, author of Fabric of the Cosmos. You're listening to Radio Times in Review. When we get back from the break, we'll hear from writer and pro-choice advocate Katha Pollitt. Hope you can join us. Welcome back to Radio Times in Review. I'm Marty Moscoane. Thanks for joining us. On Wednesday, the Supreme Court heard arguments in the case Whole Women's Health v. Helderstedt. The ruling in this case will affect access to abortions in the 10 states that have adopted strict regulations and will also have implications on the practices of abortion clinics throughout the U.S. When writer Katha Pollitt joined us, she laid out her argument for why she is so staunchly pro-choice. Her book, Pro, Reclaiming Abortion Rights, tries to debunk the myths surrounding the reasons why women choose to have this procedure, the process by which a pregnancy is terminated, and the history of this contentious political battle. Let's take a listen. You said this book is aimed at who you describe the muddled middle. These are the people in the middle of this abortion debate. How do you imagine them? What puts them in the middle, and what makes them so muddled?
Well, there are people who think abortion should be legal, but maybe with more restrictions. It's too easy to get. They really want to say that abortion is a terrible, terrible thing, except for the reasons that they think it's okay to have one. They're very big on making distinctions between a good abortion for rape or incest or life or health of the mother, and bad abortions, which is you were a slut and you got pregnant.
Those are the people that you're writing to, or
yeah,
that you want to appeal to. Was there a particular incident that got you to write this book or got you thinking about how to reframe it, as you say, this discussion about abortion?
Well, one thing was that there's been a tremendous explosion of restrictions on abortion since the Republicans were so successful in 2010. There have been 205 new restrictions in the states, including, I think, some here in Pennsylvania. The other thing was thinking about my mother, who had an illegal abortion back in 1960, and what she must have gone through. And, you know, like most women who have abortions, my mother was already a mother. And, you know, people have these stereotypes. This is what drives me crazy, which is she's a teenage slut. She's a promiscuous 20-something out on the town all the time. She's a child-hating, cold-hearted career woman, you know, just interested in making money. But those stereotypes are, besides being misogynistic, they're false. 61% of women who have abortions already have children.
Mm. Your mother, though, didn't tell anybody, including your father?
No.
Including you? I mean, this was something...
Well, she wouldn't have told me then. I was a kid.
I got you. But even so, this was something that she kept a secret, which I think a lot of women do that for their, sometimes for their own very personal reasons.
Yes. And this is another thing I wanted to talk about in the book, was that here we have one in three women having at least one abortion by menopause. Well, it's 3 in 10, but, you know, a lot.
Right.
But they're mostly silent, and this allows these stereotypes to flourish. When you read an article in the newspaper, an op-ed, it'll be, I was a rape victim, and I had an abortion, and thank God it was legal. Or this was a wanted pregnancy that went terribly medically catastrophic, and, you know, thank God I was able to have an abortion. But most abortions are for economic reasons, they're for personal reasons, they're for psychological reasons, and they're for social reasons. And that's because it takes a lot to bring a child into the world and raise it well. And women want to be in a good position to be able to do a good job at that. Why is that a bad thing? I think that's a good thing. I think it's very responsible.
But are you saying that these women have been silenced by others, or that this is just, it is a private matter? And I think for some women, it is a difficult choice. And it's a choice that they, not all women feel this way, obviously, but for some women, it is a difficult choice.
Yes, for some women, it is a difficult choice, and for some women, it's not.
And absolutely.
But I think that women don't talk about it for all kinds of reasons, but one of them is stigma. One of them is this idea that, oh, you got pregnant. That's terrible. And I, you know, I'm dealing with this, with people saying this to me on Twitter and in email. It's like, you know, there's lots of birth control out there. How can a woman do this? And I'm thinking, well, you know, birth control isn't perfect and people aren't perfect.
You also, there's an interesting history here in that, even going back to the founding of this country, there's nothing, as you write in the U.S. Constitution, that says anything about abortion. It really wasn't until, it seems like, perhaps the Civil War and some things that were happening socially or religiously in this country, that abortion became illegal.
Well, it's fascinating because now abortion has come to seem like a symbol of modernity and what people don't like about it, and irreligion and people just doing whatever they want and carelessness and all the rest of it, and women just acting up, and families falling apart. But abortion was legal in almost every state in this country until after the Civil War. And that means when we were fighting the Revolutionary War, it was legal. When George and Martha were living at Mount Vernon, it was legal. It's not in the Constitution. It could have been. The Founding Fathers could have said, oh, we really have to put that in.
Like a personhood amendment
or
something like that.
But they didn't. And it was after the Civil War when a number of things came together, and one was doctors consolidating their profession against midwives and all kinds of lay healers who were very common at the time. Another was a wave of sexual repression that also included birth control. The Comstock laws were against abortion and birth control and, quote, pornography, unquote. And that was because middle-class white women were getting married and they wanted to be part of life. They wanted to postpone their childbearing and have fewer children. Did you know that – I love this fact. Okay. So in 1800, the average American woman had, you know, 7-plus children. By 1900, it was a little less than 4 children. Well, how do you think that happened? They didn't have very good birth control then, and birth control had been criminalized. It was illegal abortion.
It was illegal abortion that brought down the birth rate.
Yes. That's what people were doing in great numbers.
But what you say in this book is that you want us to think about abortion as a part of a woman's reproductive life.
Yes, I do. I think, you know, what we want in society is for women and men to realize their ambitions and dreams and go to school and go get a job and get a better job and be able to take care of well the children that they have. This is good for everybody. And, you know, we go on and on and on about single mothers and how terrible it is. But then when a single woman gets pregnant, we say, oh, you've got to have that baby. Well, these two things don't go together. And I think that we all benefit when childbearing is planned and prepared for.
The fact that there are something like a million abortions performed every year, I mean, some would say that, well, that's a failure, not necessarily on the part of a woman per se, but also on the system, which is that if it's an unwanted pregnancy, that means that either the birth control, she didn't use the birth control, or he didn't use the birth control, or it failed, or they might not know about, you know, reproductive issues. Do you see that as just sort of, this is just the price we pay for having having a legal abortion, or is it a failure on some part?
It's a total – if I understand you correctly, it's a total failure. But the same people who are against legal abortion are also against providing birth control to all the people who need it. And we see that with what's going on with the Affordable Care Act, no copay birth control provisions. And I think that we could do much more in getting – birth control out to people, and also sex education. You know, there's still abstinence-only sex education, which, you know, no matter how often it's shown to be ineffective and fill teenagers' heads with falsehoods like condoms don't work. And then we turn around and we have all this unwanted pregnancy. We think, oh, how did that happen?
Just going back, and I'm jumping back and forth between some of the things that you write in this book, but one that really jumped out at me, and this goes back to 1968. So this is before Roe v. Wade. Ronald Reagan was the governor of California and, as you write, signed one of the most liberal abortion laws in the country.
Yes, he did. And what's fascinating about that is that now we think of the Republican Party and conservatism generally as being completely anti-abortion. But that was not always so. And another thing that's interesting that happened around the same time as America was beginning to talk about abortion and these very restrictive laws and the harm that they did was that a number of religious denominations issued statements supporting liberalized abortion laws. And one of them was the Southern Baptists. Now, today, the Southern Baptists are way out in the forefront of opposing abortion for any reason, and they're increasingly turning against birth control, which they believe falsely is an abortifacient. But back then, same Bible, they felt differently. And that shows you how political these things all are, that it's not like you can go to the Bible and find the answer. It's all about the political construction of social movements.
But do you think even the passage of Roe v. Wade then turned people against abortion? Maybe they hadn't thought about it. Maybe they even supported the idea. But something about the passage of that by the U.S. Supreme Court has created the situation that Roe is in today.
Well, when people are opposing something, they're always more energized than when people are supporting the status quo. And I think that that has really helped the anti-abortion movement because they feel you know, we're the underdog here. We are fighting this tremendous injustice, and we will never give in. Whereas the pro-choice side, I think has been a little complacent, mm-hmm. And relied on the courts. That strategy, I think, is coming back to haunt us now.
But, I mean, you have to give the people who oppose abortion, it seems, credit for being able to be as successful and effective as they have been.
Absolutely. I think it's the major grassroots movement of our time. And we used to think of grassroots as being a left-wing thing.
Right.
But the right can do it, too.
And so do you think the left has been either, as you say, complacent or just not willing to fight as overtly for this issue as you think they should?
Well, I think it's two things. I think there is the complacence, but it's related to always chasing the framing of the other side. So, for example, abortion is an agonizing decision. Why? It's not always an agonizing decision or even – mostly an agonizing decision. Mostly it's a decision women come to very quickly and they try to deal with the pregnancy as soon as they can. Why do pro-choicers say that? They say that because the anti-abortion people say their new thing is women have abortions because they're confused, they're emotionally upset, they're being bullied and pushed around, and that's why we need restrictions that will slow down the process. They need to look at an ultrasound so they'll know it's a baby. They need to have a waiting period so they can really think it over. They need to have scripts read to them by doctors that say frightening things like connect abortion with suicide and madness, mm-hmm. and cancer and all kinds of things like that. So our side is basically saying, women are moral actors. They do take this seriously. But the way they do it is to sort of ratchet up the negativity in such a way that I think it increases the stigma. It basically says, you know, you really should agonize over this. If you get pregnant and you think, I want to graduate from college, I'm having an abortion, instead of maybe I should drop out and have a baby, then you're frivolous.
Well, one of the arguments that you make is that while there's all this focus and attention on the pregnancy, that once the baby is born, and oftentimes born to a low-income mother, there aren't the kinds of services that would help her be the kind of mother that she wants to be, with childcare and daycare and all the sort of social services to help families.
It's true. The same people who say, oh, you got pregnant, too bad for you, you have to have a baby. Then when the baby is born, say, oh, you have a baby, that's not my problem. And there are, you know, I want to say there are anti-abortion people who are concerned with poverty issues.
Are.
But, you know, their proposals are always – they're very small scale, like let's have more food stamps. A little more daycare for poor women. But there's nothing like you would find in a European social welfare state where enabling children to be brought up not in poverty is important. Mm.
Do you think, though, that this is sort of bottom line then about women having sex and perhaps getting pregnant when they don't want to, and in a sense punishing them for being sexual?
Yes, I think that is part of a big part of the bottom line. I think part of it is thinking motherhood is kind of what women are here for.
Even in 2014?
I think so. I think it is. Motherhood is kind of what women are here for, and if they're going to not be mothers, they have to have a really excellent reason. But there's also, I think, a lot of people are upset at disconnecting sex from reproduction. So there is this idea, you have sex, 9 months later, that's a contract. You've signed a contract to have a baby. And I don't think that that is the way real life works, and mm-hmm. I don't think that's the way people think about sex or ever have. But I think that that's in there.
I just want to pick up one thing, and I think you referenced this in your book, but I've also thought about it as well. is that you don't see and protesters have the absolute right to protest outside of Planned Parenthood or other abortion providers, but you don't see them outside of IVF clinics.
This is so true. I mean, if you believe that the fertilized egg is a person from the moment of conception, and actually I have to say here, conception is actually a process that takes about 24 hours. There is no magic moment where it happens. But if you believe that, you have to be – the Catholic Church is right. You have to be against in vitro fertilization, which they are. Because, look, it's in a petri dish. It's not a person. It's in a woman. It is a person. This makes no sense. But you don't see – you don't see protesters outside fertility clinics, and that's what lets you know that this is about women and sex, because a woman, a couple goes into a fertility clinic, they're trying to have a child, and that's good. She's fulfilling her, you know, her role. And the fact that in order to create that baby, fertilized eggs have to, and zygotes have to be sacrificed. Is not very interesting. But logically it should be.
The difference is that the woman or the couple are trying to have a baby, and therefore those, what, embryos are viewed differently.
Yeah, it
even
shows
if they're
you,
discarded.
It shows you what it's really all about is that people perceive abortion as rejecting maternity. But it isn't rejecting maternity most of the time. Most women already have kids. They've accepted maternity. They're trying to have a family that they can manage. That's a good thing. So, you know, if you're anti-abortion, you should be anti-fertility medicine.
That was my interview with writer and pro-choice advocate Katha Pollitt about her book Pro, Reclaiming Abortion Rights. You're listening to Radio Times in Review. When we get back from the break, we'll revisit my conversation with actor Wendell Pierce. Stay with us. Welcome back to Radio Times in Review. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. We close out our show today by listening to a portion of my conversation with actor Wendell Pierce. Most well known for his roles in The Wire and Tremé, he'll be portraying Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas in the upcoming HBO movie Confirmation. When he joined us last year, we discussed his upbringing in New Orleans, which he chronicled in his memoir, The Wind in the Reeds, as well as his training at Juilliard and some of his most memorable roles. Let's take a listen. You do describe a pretty idyllic childhood. You could play outside. And you also said that as a kid, and you're one of three brothers, that you were loved. I mean, it was clear that you were loved. And there were people looking out for other people as well.
You know, people recognize this. It's not unique just to my neighborhood, but we have mothers and fathers all around the community that took care of you. You felt safe, especially in the time when it was threatened. Gentilly Woods was next to us. It was a neighborhood that was not too friendly to us because it was still segregated times. Segregation had ended by the time I was a child, the segregation of the mind and spirit was still there. But it was a place where the parents took care of you, and you felt loved, and more importantly, it was expected of you to do whatever you could. And that was the sort of thing that I realized came from the legacy of my family, that this resilience we needed to rebuild New Orleans, this awakening that I had with the art showed me that culturally, that intersection between life and people itself, we live our culture more than any other place that I'm familiar with. We live our culture in New Orleans, and our culture has always been about that resilience. And it's always been a part of my family, too. And I recognized in all the lessons that my mother and father and my grandparents were teaching me was this legacy that was being passed on. So a part of my awakening was to remember and realize that I'm a part of something larger and eternal, you know, something spiritual, even. And a part of that lesson was there are those that do not have your best interest at heart. And then also my grandfather had a mantra, which was can't die 3 days before the creation of the world. Don't ever tell me you can't do something.
Oh, wow.
Right?
Powerful
and so
words,
that was
yeah.
powerful words. So it wasn't if I was going to go to college. It's, you know, what college are you going to? My niece, fifth generation, is here, you know, in Philadelphia at Drexel. And so she continues on that legacy. And that was always a part of the culture that I grew up with in New Orleans. The social aid and pleasure clubs, the creation of jazz itself captured Africans, allowed to play the bambula and dance on Sundays. Hearing that, and hearing the brass music of their captors, and combining it to jazz, one of the greatest expressions of the American aesthetic. Although I am confined, captured, my aspirational freedom is expressed in the creation of the art, which leads to my aspirational freedom, physical freedom, that ultimately I'm going to get to. It was the incubator of that insurrection where they went away and fought for generations to get to that place of freedom. It was there in Congo Square where the creation of this American aesthetic of jazz, where other people, free people of color who had come from Haiti, created the seeds of the modern social justice movement, of the civil rights movement. You know, Paul Levine and Homer Plessy that we're all familiar with, Plessy versus Ferguson, right there in Treme, right on the grounds of Congo Square. So it was an artistic and activism, an incubator for activism also. The two are combined. And that was the tradition of New Orleans culture and art. It was revelatory.
Did you play an instrument? I mean, clearly you became an actor, but did you
yes.
play an instrument as a kid growing
every
up?
Every little boy in New
trombone
Orleans.
Trombone by any chance?
Every little boy in New Orleans grabs a trumpet first,
okay,
right? Because, you
fair,
know,
yes.
You look cooler, I guess, if you play trumpet.
Yeah.
And I actually had to turn my trumpet back in because I was so bad.
Really?
Yeah, I didn't practice. So it was really, Mr. Lewis said, Mr. Pierce, play that one line. And I said, which one? And I tried to play it. And he's like, you haven't practiced. Turn your horn back in. But I learned to play trombone for the show of Treme.
Well, and I have to ask you about that, and I can't tell you how many people came up to me knowing that I was going to interview you mm-hmm. saying, how did Wendell Pierce fake playing that trombone because it looked so real?
Well, I learned every tune. I learned every solo.
So you knew
the positions of the slide. And just off camera was Stafford Agee from the Rebirth Brass Band, and they actually recorded him. But we mirrored each other.
So you could see him.
I could see him. He could see me. And, I made sure that my slide was in position. They made sure they didn't put a mic on my horn because I sounded like a fifth grader. And he sounds like the world-class jazz yeah. musician that he is. But, I mean, to this day, it was, 3 years ago, I still remember my first solo. You know, so
did you get better? I mean, as
I got better. I actually, you know, and some nights I tried to sit in with Rebirth, got up on the stage at the Maple Leaf Bar where they play every Tuesday night and tried to play with
them. How'd you do?
I was awful. Sometimes I was good. You know, what happens is I got a little liquid courage in me, you know, and then that became the joke. Get him to play because, you know, he thinks he sounds good,
yeah, exactly.
You know, but sometimes I hung in there.
You wrote about getting this part in The Wire, and you actually had a little altercation yes. in New York, gotten yourself arrested after having a fist fight with the cab driver, and you were so angry. I guess it sounds like you just sort of vented. And
I came into the audition venting, and I just said, I can't believe that, you know, what happened to me, and this guy didn't want to take me, and I just vented about, you know, I get out of the cab, I'm not going to pay him, he takes a swing at me, we get in a fight, the police pass by, and they arrest me. Oh, so I was mad, and I went off. Cut to,
yeah.
weeks later, months later, actually, working on The Wire, sitting around waiting for a setup, and David said, you know, when you came in for the audition, and you told that story about getting arrested, I said, oh, yeah. He said, that was bunk. And that's when you got the part. None of your readings. You know, when you told that story, we realized, oh, yeah, that's bunk.
Was there a real bunk in Baltimore? I mean, someone
yes,
that you did actually.
I actually worked with. He is a dear friend, Oscar Requeir. He is the bunk. And he came to see me work. I worked with him, you know, and, you know, kind of prepared and did research with him. And he came the first day I was shooting, pulled up in his Cadillac, had a cigar, and he was in the distance. And he looked at me so strange with his face wrinkled up going, what? And it's like, what is this boy doing? Right. And I was so afraid of his opinion of my work and me portraying this fictionalized bunk that I didn't talk to him for 5 years.
Wow.
I never talked to him. And one day someone said, you know, he's retiring and you better be there. And I went to the retirement party. I said, oh, yes, I'm going to be there. I went there and I walked in. I could see him across the room looking at me quizzically. And then all of a sudden he said, hey, Bunk, you made me famous. Come here. And it was like the prodigal son coming home. And we've been dear friends ever since. And I owe him a call.
Just a couple more questions about growing up in New Orleans. You talk about going to the New Orleans Symphony, hearing Peter and the Wolf. I mean, that you were just sort of like bathed, I guess, in this culture. How could you not? I don't know.
Growing up, it was an annual thing. It was three events a year that we were able to go to. It usually was a traveling troupe of a play. There was definitely going to be some jazz, you know, because we had so many great jazz musicians around. And then we would go to the symphony.
Yeah.
And I don't know why, but all symphonies believe that kids only can deal with Peter and the Wolf, you know.
It's
a great little piece of music. Yeah. And I loved it because it just, I knew what to expect and, you know, I was learning the song and all. But it really just cultivated a love of culture in me and realized that a sense of expression, a sense of individuality, a sense of purpose, a sense that you have something to say, a sense of creativity, a sense of improvisation, to have the flexibility to change. And just like school is a gym for your intellectual muscle, that's what the artistic muscle needs. And we have forgotten that in America. We think of our art and our culture as just entertainment. And entertainment is a residual of art. It is the forum in which you reflect on who you are, what thoughts are to the individual. That's what art is to the community as a whole, where you reflect on who you are and who you hope to be. And that's where we declare our values and then act on them. And that sort of connection to culture was something that was annual, a daily, weekly event for me, and living in New Orleans because we live our culture. We sing when we talk, hey, Marty, hey, baby, how you doing, baby? And then I went to NOCA, which is the New Orleans Center for Creative Arts.
Well, you went on to Juilliard to study there. But there's something you write in the book that I thought so interesting, and you said so critical to performance, and you call it shedding.
Oh, shedding. Well,
shedding.
Every jazz musician knows that's getting in the woodshed. And practicing for hours and making sure you're a student of your craft. Mm-hmm. So because if you're a student of your craft, then you realize that you can really explore it. It's the idea of being an artist is knowing that there's a finite amount of letters with an infinite amount of possibility of combinations. It's like the jazz musician who understands that there's a finite amount of notes but an infinite amount of combinations. There's an infinite amount of expressions for the actor to ply your craft and put your imprint in that, like a seal of wax on a piece of wood or painting that'll last for generations over time that a visual artist has. That comes from shedding.
And I know your mom was a teacher.
Yes, my mother was a teacher, and that was really a tribute to her. And what Treme was for me was beyond a television show. While it was therapeutic for everyone as we reflected on what we were going through, and that's what its role was as a piece of art. It was also a godsend for me. The last years I got to spend with my mother and honor her in tribute of being a teacher, because she was a teacher for like 40 years.
What'd she teach?
She taught first grade.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and I was known for years as Mrs. Pierce's son in my neighborhood. And to come home and see her friends who were my teachers at the school going, oh, Pierce, he has homework. Don't let him get away with anything. It was she was a blessed woman and really gave me the spirit of the desire to do whatever I desired to do.
You write in your book, her death was without a doubt the most profound experience you've ever gone through.
Absolutely. Like I said, Treme brought me home in a way it was divine intervention. I got to spend the last years and last moments with my mother. I held her in my arms and put her to bed as she took her last breath and said, that was a good one.
Wow.
Her last words to me,
that was a good one.
And it was about the fact that I was finally just able to just hold her and comfort. I hope I gave her comfort in the final moments of her life as much as she gave me comfort. I would spend so much time just rubbing her back because I remember
she used to rub your back.
As a child how she would rub my back. Mm. And that brought me such comfort. I think about a mother's touch to this day. And she was a woman of great faith and challenged my faith. I did a pilgrimage for my 50th birthday, trying to reconnect with my mother. I went to Fatima in Portugal. And as a pilgrim was there, my mother asked that I try to reconnect going to church and reconnect with my spirituality. And I'm the first to say that I'm challenged with that. And in that moment, I realized that I was grieving her. I really went there hoping to find her. And as I looked up as they were having the procession of the Blessed Mother going back to her place of honor, all the pilgrims raised their handkerchiefs up. And all of a sudden, thousands of miles away, I was right back at a second line.
Wow.
The way we honor our death and honor our loved ones at home. And that's when I really finally said goodbye to my mother.
Mm. Your dad's still alive, right?
My dad is still alive. I just saw him this weekend.
In his 90s, right?
He's 90. He's going to be 91 in January. We celebrated his birthday this year with a big bash. And he's a huge Saints fan. And and he is he challenged me as an artist, and he's a man who loves his country even when his country didn't love him. A man of great character. He was disappointed that I chose to be an actor because I had the possibility to do whatever I wanted. I was going to that great public private school he called Ben Franklin, which was one of the best schools in the state of Louisiana, is the best school and one of the best in the country. But he didn't deny me my pursuit of acting, because his principled belief is if it's something you want to do, just give your heart. And he honored that. He said, I don't want to be a part of it, but if that's something you want to do, you go on and do it. I'm not going to do it. And then on Broadway, opening night, I brought him up to New York. And I said, remember that time you said you're not going to bring me to any more plays or rehearsals? That's not what you are part of. I said, yeah. He said, yeah. I said, you remember that? He says, yes. I said, I want you to remember tonight just as much. And he says, son, I will, and I'm very proud of you.
Oh, nice. It's nice when sons can hear that from their dads.
And that's really just the legacy of family and what true resilience is and true character is. And that was a part of the culture of New Orleans, and seen in our resilience, in our music, in our arts, and even our culinary arts, taking scraps from the table, putting it together with some burnt flour, building a stew that's known around the world as gumbo. A gumbo is not only something that gives you sustenance of spirit and creativity, but literal sustenance to your body, artistic sustenance to your body. We live our culture, that intersection between life and its people, our culture.
That was my conversation with actor Wendell Pierce, recorded last year. He'll be portraying Justice Clarence Thomas in the upcoming HBO drama Confirmation. And that wraps up this week's edition of Radio Times in Review. Thanks for joining us. Radio Times is produced by Debbie Builder, Emily Bryant, Liz Fiedler, and John Ahrens, who edits the show. I'm Marty Moscowane. Have a great weekend. And a sister's mom, and a blessed time.